See Rome Vault Podcast, episode number 402. Tuesday, June 22nd, 2021.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, everybody. So I'm back in Bellows Falls. I spent the weekend down south, mostly in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, but every day driving down to Perryville, Maryland to pick up my two sons. And on Friday, I drove down and picked up my mother and my two sons and brought them back up to Lancaster and hung out at Kevin Lynn's place. My mom didn't want to make that drive the next day. So the next day it was just me and the boys. But as we like to do, we played Pandemic, Reign of Cthulhu, and cooked frozen pizzas and ate them. And anyway, got on the scale this morning, 227.4 pounds. This is as heavy as I've been really since 2001, 2002. And it just will not do. So today is day one of what I'm thinking is going to be a 3-day fast. Although if I get to Friday and I feel like, you know, stretching it out for two more days, I might turn it into a 5-day fast. We'll see. But as I mentioned in a video that I was just shooting, but I'm not going to post today. I'm going to keep sort of a video log and I'll post the results of my fast on Friday. I had somebody, I was at a friend's place and it was a cookout. And I just asked him to, you know, hand it to my phone, ask him to take a picture. I was going to send it to Rose on WhatsApp. And I saw the photo and, you know, I'll use it as the cover art, you know, so you probably have access to it. My face is red. I mean, it was a hot day and I walked over in the sun and all, but I'm just looking so large and it's just not a pleasant picture. It doesn't match my self-image. So fasting begins now. Well, again, I guess last night, but for at least the next 2.5 days, no food, maybe longer. All right. Well, a little while ago, I don't even know how long it's been. It's not like I'm counting the days, but I said that I was going to write 1,000 words a day for 21 days straight. And I suppose I should go back and start counting those 1,000-word essays on my Patreon page. But I'm going to start off reading the one that I composed on June 17th, I think that was Thursday, that was the day that I left. And Thursday's 1,000 words got broken up into two different posts, one before I left and one after I arrived at my destination after a long day's driving. But here's what I wrote before the long day's driving. A day on the road. It's Thursday morning. In about an hour and a half, a friend of mine will come by and pick me up and drive me half an hour south to Brattleboro, where I will pick up a rental car. Then I'll spend the next 8 to 10 hours driving. I'm hoping it's closer to 8 hours, but there's no telling. While on the road, I'll finish listening to the 5-hour conversation between Lex Fridman and Charles Hoskinson, the founder of Cardano. I also have two new science fiction audiobooks that I picked up on a 2-for-1 sale on Audible. One I have already started, the other remains uncracked, so to speak. The one I've already started, Ancillary Sword, is the sequel to Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie. It's a space opera tale of an AI on a quest for revenge. The premise of the story is that the Ratch, an authoritarian expansionist human empire, uses AI-controlled spaceships in their conquest. The ships have a crew of human officers, but most of the work done by human bodies, including soldiering, is done by the bodies of humans taken from past conquered worlds and slaved to the ship's AI. The ship has innumerable mechanical sensors on board, but it also takes in sensory input from its fleshy robots called ancillaries. And I'm listening to this on Audible rather than reading the text, and, you know, being an American, I would pronounce that word ancillaries. But because it is a British narrator, I'm hearing it as ancillaries. The personality of the original human is destroyed when the ship inhabits the body, but the ships are not evil. They have no more choice in the matter than does anyone except the supreme leader sitting atop the hierarchy. In the story of the first novel, one such ship is destroyed, and only a single ancillary escapes. The vast mind of the ship has been poured into a tiny vessel, that being the human ancillary, and so most of its capabilities are lost. But a ship mind in the body of a human has superhuman capabilities. This super soldier lays out a long game plan for revenge. I can't really say anything about the plot of the sequel, Ancillary Sword, without giving away the end of the first novel, but I'm glad to have it in my brain. The other audiobook, the one I haven't started, is Transition by Ian M. Banks, author of the Culture novels. So as I can tell, this one doesn't have anything to do with the Culture. It takes place on Earth, or perhaps multiple Earths, in the 1990s or early 2000s. I love Banks' writing, and I'm nostalgic for the 90s, so that's a good combination. Long drives are also good for spending time in enforced silence. Generally, the idea on a multi-hour solo drive is to reduce the subjective time spent behind the wheel as much as possible within the realm of safety. No sleeping, no getting killed. Death would certainly reduce my subjective experience of the tedium of driving, but it also defeats the purpose of my travel. During the periods where I'm not listening to anything and in which the next navigation point is a long way off, my mind can sometimes go to interesting places. But there's also the possibility of the cognitive equivalent of getting stuck in the mud and spinning my wheels. Lots of unproductive repetition of conditioned thought. I've also found that ideas typically come to me when I first start writing or talking into a microphone. Talking into a video camera is a slightly different process that produces a different product, with a different timbre. But the principle is the same. Ideas have to be arrived at after some travel, and that travel typically doesn't begin until I start typing or hit record. I've written 600 words so far, but I need to get on with packing and cleaning up my apartment a bit. The same friend who is driving me down to the rental car office will also stop in to check on my cat. I'm embarrassed to imagine her moving through my disorganized and untended man cave. Another 400 words when I arrive at my destination tonight. And then after I arrived at Kevin's place, I sat down and cranked out what was supposed to be another 400 words. I think it's a bit more than that. I wrote the other 400. I'm at my destination in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. I arrived about 2.5 hours and several Jack Daniels ago. I took modafinil for the road, and as a result, I'm buzzed from the Jack, but not remotely sleepy. We'll see if the melatonin can put a dent in that laser focus. My chariot for this journey is a Toyota Camry. It has radar-enhanced cruise control, so that if the car in front of me is going slower than I am, my car will slow down to maintain a safe distance. My journey started in Vermont, and traffic on 91 South was sparse enough that the cruise control could just let up on the gas in order to keep that buffer zone between me and the car ahead of me. When I got into Massachusetts, I discovered that it wasn't afraid to hit the brakes when necessary. Unfortunately, the cruise control would shut down if I dropped below about 20 miles per hour, so I couldn't count on it in stop-and-go traffic. And it's hard to drive from Brattleboro, Vermont to Lancaster, Pennsylvania without hitting some bumper-to-bumper traffic. I passed through Vermont, Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania today. Tomorrow I will push on to Maryland. I stopped for lunch at a Burger King in Bridgeport, Connecticut. As I approached the front door, I looked for some sign regarding mask use. I had a disposable mask in my pocket, but I'm fully vaccinated, and if that status doesn't get me out of having to wear a mask, then I'll be demanding a full refund of the $0 I paid to get vaxxed. There was nothing posted on the door, but when I got inside, all the staff were wearing masks. The only person ahead of me in line was wearing a mask. I expected to be scolded for not doing so, and I was rehearsing my lines for that interaction as I awaited my turn to order. The masked man at the counter, the only white employee that I saw, said nothing about my unmasked status. After I ordered, and as I waited for my food to be ready, more customers came in. They were all African Americans, and they were all masked. When my food was ready, it came in a bag, even though I fully intended to eat it in the restaurant. The man who took my order handed it to me and said, "Have a blessed day." Actually, he said, "Blessed day." But when I see that word, B-L-E-S-S-E-D, to me it's blessed. The woman in line behind me complained to the man who took my order about the three men asleep in the lounge area at the front of the restaurant. I had not noticed them when I walked in, but I looked, and there they were. There were two middle-aged white men sitting at a table, both sitting up, obviously asleep, and one younger black man slumped in a high-backed leather chair. He was also asleep, but I later came to think that he was more than just asleep. I took a table near the front of the restaurant, but not anywhere close to the three men. One of the middle-aged white men had what looked like to be a week's worth of beard. The other one had the kind of beard that it would take me a year or more to grow. They both stirred from time to time, and the one with the full beard actually got up and walked around for a bit, looking at his smartphone the whole time. The younger black man never stirred or uttered a sound. I suspect that his slumber was opioid-enhanced. After I finished eating, I went to the toilet. I don't like to pee in public restrooms, but I equally dislike having a full bladder when I'm hours from my destination. I sidled up to the one urinal, and just as I got the flow going, a large bald man walked into the restroom. He said something unintelligible to me and proceeded into the one stall. I pissed and then washed my hands. As I was drying my hands under the loud air dryer, he came out of the stall, said something unintelligible to me, and walked out. When I exited the restroom, he was standing in the center of the restaurant, and he looked at me and said something that sounded like humble fish. "Humble fish?" I asked. He smiled a half-wicked, half-clueless grin and said, with crisper but still limp enunciation, "Humble fish." I stepped back and pulled out my phone and pretended to check my email. This large, bald man was fat, but not flabby, pathetic fat. He was the kind of fat that looked like it just lent mass and force to whatever violence he might do. But he seemed simple. He spoke to an older man who was sitting alone at a table and then ambled out. I paused and spoke to that same older man. "I'm just going to let him get a head start," I said. The older man smiled and said something, though I either didn't catch what he said or it didn't make it into long-term memory. He had a disposable mask hanging from one ear. I was pretty sure I was in Connecticut, but not positive, so I asked the man if I was, in fact, in Connecticut. "Oh, you're from someplace else?" he said in a thick but completely understandable accent. I can't really tell Central American accents apart. To me, there's only Mexican and everything else. His accent was some variety of everything else. We had a very pleasant, if superficial, exchange in which I asked him if there was still a mask mandate in effect in Connecticut. Aside from myself, the only other maskless people were the simple giant and the three loitering men. The older man said that masks were not required, but that he still chose to wear one. When I saw that the large, simple, and vaguely creepy man was no longer in front of the restaurant, I wished the older man a good day and departed. It's not 2020 anymore, but it's still weird out there in the wider world. I wonder how long it will be before I don't always have a mask in my pocket. So in response to that, I got some comments from folks representing different parts of the country. Gus writes, "I guess I thought my experience was more universal. 80% of mask usage disappeared in North Carolina upon the CDC guidance change 3 to 4 weeks ago. Even in Asheville, which is roughly our Austin/Portland feeling area. And just took a vacation in South Carolina where almost no mask can be seen." Whereas Benjamin writes, "Most people in Auburn, New York go around on masks. I have to wager that a percentage are not vaccinated, but no, they won't be asked for vaccination proof. Most places have signage specifying that you don't have to mask if vaccinated." And Rick writes, "I'm on Maryland's eastern shore, a ways south from where you're heading. It's been several weeks at least since I've had to wear a mask as a customer at an establishment, Walmart, Home Depot, local restaurants, etc. Still see employees wearing masks at some places, and there are still citizens masking up. Governor Hogan ended the mask mandate in mid-May, and that's about when I started noticing the mask required signs starting to come down. Nowadays, I don't see any of those signs. I don't carry a mask on my person anymore, but have a couple in the car." And Mark C. writes, "Hope this trip continues to be interesting and yet uneventful. Masks? People here wear them or don't, and like more serious things, there's no enforcement either way. Me, I like masks. My wife, who gets seriously sick every year from her work with toddlers, skipped that this year, and I credit masks. I also have a mask ready for all situations in which I would like to have one but never did, and a ready excuse to wear it. Garages, where welding, painting, and spilled fuel are the norm, construction sites, all much easier now. Then again, most people can probably just avoid those areas entirely. The guy in the restroom, was he trying a pickup? You know, I don't think he was. I just don't know what that guy's deal was, other than, you know, he's just not all there. That sort of thing was really common in California. Had to run a gauntlet of requests for blowjobs and God knows what else in public restrooms all over L.A. Yeah. Did I mention I don't like public restrooms? I mean, I'm glad they exist, and I'm certainly grateful that certain ones existed at certain places when I really, really needed them, but I prefer to plan ahead and not have to use them. All right, so the next... I haven't actually looked at it yet, but I think the next essays delve into other topics, and I want to stay here on traveling and masks. And just to start with, it's just weird, you know, the United States... It's a single country, but the various states differ from one another considerably. You know, they each have different court systems, they have different public policies, different enforcement priorities for police. And they're different in their approach to masks and the pandemic. And of course, a lot of that's the big red-blue divide. Vermont is a hyper blue state, and we still don't let passenger Amtrak into the state, which is really annoying. So I would much rather ride a train down to, near where my kids live and just rent a car for the day while I'm there than have to rent one up here and drive all that way. But then when I get into a place like the Burger King where I ate in Bridgeport, Connecticut on the way down, everybody's wearing a mask. Most of the people working in the kitchen don't get anywhere near the customers. So are they wearing masks to protect themselves from each other? I'm just not sure how that works. I mean, the guy who's taken my order, there was also the hanging piece of plastic, the shield, which has become pretty common since the start of the pandemic. And I noticed that even though the mask mandate has gone at my local grocery store, those big shields between me and the cashier remain. But then I wonder about the customers in the restaurant. I think of all the people in the restaurant, not including the three guys who were just loitering up front, but I think of customers, only one of them was younger than me. Everybody else was older, which to me suggests that if they wanted it, they had access to the vaccine before I did. Maybe, and I'm going to get to vaccine paranoia pretty soon, but are there people for whom... they think that the vaccine is dangerous and that it's gonna kill millions of people. I haven't done a wide survey, of such beliefs, but I get the impression that most of the people who believe that the vaccine is deadly and will be killing people, and seriously depopulating the Earth, like over the next 2 years, supposedly most of the people, according to this view, most of the people who got vaccinated are going to die in the next 2 years. I imagine, for any viewpoint, there's got to be somebody that holds it, right? So I suppose there's got to be somebody out there who thinks that the virus or, the pandemic is legit, but who also thinks that the powers that be are going to use the pretext of the pandemic to carry out this massive population cull, to kill most of the people. Ironically, they're killing the most subservient of the population and leaving the most cantankerous alive. If this belief system is valid, if this belief system has, any truth to it. And, I'm saying this, I'm fully vaccinated. If the people who got the vaccines are going to die in the next 2 years, well, I'm among them. I'm going to die skinny, goddammit. Now, maybe you noticed that in the essay, I was always specific about the race of the people that I was interacting with, or in the case of the man with the unplaceable, by me, Latino accent, I'm guessing he's from somewhere in Central America that's south of Mexico. I mention everybody's race just because I live in Vermont. I live in this almost entirely uniformly white monoculture. At least it's a racial monoculture. Culturally, there's some definite tribal lines here. And I don't fit neatly into any of the tribal categories represented around here. I mean, the one that I'm closest to, the big ones are just blue and red. In the 60s and 70s, a lot of young idealistic hippies moved here, and those that haven't died off since then, most of them are still here. And they define a good portion of the culture and the state's political climate. But then you also have, working class people from families that were here before the hippies got here, and they tend to be rather conservative. So those are your main lines of cultural antagonism around here. But then there's a third category, and that's the people who've moved here from someplace else, most of whom sold property, real estate, in a place where real estate is very expensive, and came here and bought a bigger but much cheaper house and had lots of money left over. I came here in the company of such a person, but I am not myself such a person. And now that Olga and I have split up and I don't live with her, I don't socialize with that third tribe anymore. You know, the people who used to live elsewhere and who moved here because their money went a lot further and it's so cute and quaint. But there are a few black people around, but there is no black community. Except, I suppose, a group of Jamaican workers who come in every summer to work two nearby farms. You know, these are larger commercial farms, and those workers, for the most part, they don't get out into the community. They work all day, and they hang out together at night, and they spend as little money as possible because, you know, they're here working seasonally to save up money and send it home. So while I see them working in the fields as I drive by, you know, when I had a car anyway, I never encounter them here in the village. And Connecticut, you know, Connecticut's very strange in that you've got pockets of extreme wealth in Connecticut, but you've also got a lot of poverty. And a pretty high, you know, at least as far as I can tell from driving through it, the poor areas are mostly black, or largely black. There was a book I read, I was in Seattle when I read it, so it was in the 90s. It was called Cold New World. And it was stories of, I think, four different people, one of whom was a young black male drug dealer in New Haven, Connecticut, which is where Yale is. So you have, you know, the sons and daughters of extreme privilege in New Haven, along with lots of poor, struggling, desperate people. And I just looked up the book on Amazon. The full title is Cold New World, Growing Up in a Harder Country, by William Finnegan. And it was published in 1999, which, you know, talking about economic hardship in this country in 1999 seems kind of quaint, right? The book was clearly written before the dot-com crash and almost a decade before the 2008 financial meltdown. I see that Amazon advertises two of William Finnegan's books together, this one, Cold New World, and another one called Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life. But of Cold New World, Joyce Carol Oates writes, quote, Cold New World is a sustained and unflinching look into the lives of young Americans who live in poverty of varying kinds. Economic, social, intellectual, spiritual. Part of the appeal of this gathering of life portraits and first-hand revelations is that Finnegan can so adroitly place himself in the center of Cold New World as its brooding, conscience-stricken, and culturally privileged witness, even as he allows his subjects the full range of their mercurial humanity. Despite its pessimism, Cold New World is brimming with a quickened, heated life and surprises of the sort adolescents invariably provide their astonished elders. So when I read this book, you know, in the final year or two of the 20th century, living in Seattle, I'm not sure I'd ever been to Connecticut. And then, you know, years later, I certainly had been to Connecticut before I moved to Vermont. But, you know, once I was living in Vermont and I was regularly traveling south to see my kids, you know, driving south, the state in which I spend the most time on any drive south usually is Connecticut. And I broke down in Connecticut once and had to be towed, and the area that I got towed to was clearly very prosperous. But then at other times, you know, I've gotten off the highway to seek food or a bathroom and found myself in definitely not so prosperous places, harder places, more desperate places. And I was reminded repeatedly of this book, Cold New World, Growing Up in a Harder Country by William Finnegan. And staying on the topic of race, you know, I've mentioned many times, I'm sure, that I mostly came of age. You know, I was a teenager and a young adult in Kansas City, Missouri, a place with a high black population. And I was a, you know, a young man and a risk taker and didn't have much money. And My travels through the various subcultures of Kansas City, Missouri included, you know, a lot of black subcultures. Or a lot of mixed race subcultures, I should say. And when, you know, partying or socializing with black people, there was never any conceit that, you know, we were a colorblind group. It was clear who was black and who was white, but, you know, we also clearly had things in common. And it just seemed more carefree than when I got to the University of Missouri at Columbia, which is, you know, a couple hours drive from Kansas City. But I went from, you know, attending community colleges in a city to going to a state university campus. And where I had mixed freely with black people, you know, in my city-dwelling life, on the college campus, it was strictly segregated. And, you know, it wasn't a segregation that was imposed from above upon the black students. The black students just, they kept to themselves for the most part. You know, they had their own fraternities and sororities, and they were really intense about them. I don't remember which one it was, but there was one black fraternity that was, it was notorious for branding its members, like, you know, taking a piece of metal, shaping it into the shape of the symbol that you want to impress upon your members, heating it up and then burning somebody's skin to, you know, to create this raised scar. And I remember that there was just a lot of racial tension on the campus. And then my last, like, you know, I was an undergraduate there, then I went to Japan, then I came back to the US and I went to grad school and I went to that same school. And then after that, you know, after in my last summer in Columbia, Missouri, I went with a couple of friends to the SIGGRAPH. This is the Special Interest Group in Graphics Conference, which that year was held in New Orleans. This is before Hurricane Katrina. And I have not been back to New Orleans since then. But I got down there and I was a little bit shocked, you know, after having spent years on that college campus where there is such, you know, unspoken, for the most part unspoken, but clear animosity, you know, between blacks and whites on the campus, to get down to New Orleans where, you know, surely racial issues are much more intense there, right? But there was just this ease of moving in and out of black and white spaces. There were fewer black and white spaces in New Orleans. It just seemed really mixed and permeable. Whereas in Columbia, Missouri, you know, on the college campus and in the college town, it was not permeable. There were black spaces and there were white spaces. And sometimes black people had to be in white spaces, but they did so in groups and they clearly had a, you know, a defensive attitude about them. And it was just strange moving from that racially charged, intense atmosphere of privilege to a more egalitarian, even though there were, you know, clearly great differences in wealth between some people and others, you know, working people and what John Michael Greer would call, you know, the salary class and the wage class. But there was just socially, it just seemed so friction-free. Now, granted, I was a visitor there. I didn't live there. And when you visit a place, you get a very different impression than you will, you know, form if you stay there for months or years. But I've just noticed, you know, from like in the 80s and 90s in Kansas City, early 90s, there was no notion, there was no pretense of, you know, being colorblind. But at the same time, there wasn't, in my experience, that much tension between white and black people until I got to the college campus. And then there was a lot of tension. And then I went to Seattle and I was, you know, working at Amazon in the corporate tech scene. And that was, you know, very mixed. And then I left the country for a while. And then when I came back, I was in Northwest Arkansas, which is very white. You know, not many people of color in Northwest Arkansas. There's a lot of people of color down in the River Valley, you know, in down near Little Rock, and particularly on the eastern side of Arkansas, you know, over near the Tennessee border. But in the northwest corner of Arkansas, up in the Ozarks, it's mostly white. So there wasn't much racial tension because there weren't really black populations to be tense around. The racial tension there was between, you know, the whites who had been there for generations and the newcomer Central Americans. My grandmother called them Mexicans, but she didn't know any of them. And I don't think very many of them were from Mexico. But there's a Tyson chicken plant in town, and Tyson chicken, you know, Tyson meats, where they can, they hire the cheapest labor possible. And that's usually immigrant labor, usually illegal or undocumented. everybody on my mother's side of the family had worked at that chicken plant at one point or another because, you know, they were working class people, but in a rural area and they needed the money. Everybody worked there at one point or another. Now, only the managers are white. And if you walk by the plant, and you probably don't want to, it smells bad, but right across the street, like there's a crosswalk and right across the street from the plant is a, you know, like a payday loan place that specializes in remittances, and all the signs in the window are all in Spanish. And they're talking about, you know, what they charge for you to send your paycheck back home. And what I'm working around to is that with the pandemic, even with the, you know, the Black Lives Matter aspect of the pandemic, with all the demonstrations, or, you know, depending on your point of view, you can call them riots, whatever. Even with lots of people ginning up racial tension for cynical purposes, you know, even with the mainstream media, you know, fully on board with BLM and, you know, and shaming white people, the tension, the social cultural tension when I move out in the world right now is a lot more intense between groups of white people than it is between groups of white and black people or, you know, other racial subcultures. The red-blue tribe antagonism, you know, is certainly part of it. But there's also the everybody on board with, you know, vote blue no matter who, whatever you're told to say, you know, whatever the standard line is, we're going to not only say it, but we're going to double down on it. And we're gleefully going to rip to pieces anybody who shows any resistance. And then there are the people who resist, who normally, I think, for the most part, would just be natural blue tribe members. But they've been bullied and they've been pushed and they're now starting to resist. And they're coming to realize that there are ways to resist. Like, you know, you can't coordinate with other such people on Facebook very well. You'll get kicked off. And I'm not sure if I've told you this already on the podcast, but, you know, there's Clubhouse. Clubhouse is this audio-only social media platform. And when my first few days on Clubhouse was mostly around the podcasting communities. And then I got really turned off by that because, you know, in the podcasting communities, podcasting is just, it's like multi-level marketing now. You know, people who are just looking to get ahead in life, they just understand that if you have a business, your business has to include a podcast. And so, you know, the podcasting rooms, the podcasting events on Clubhouse, to me, really feel like, you know, putting on the suit and tie and going to the Chamber of Commerce meeting. Everybody is, you know, you're wearing your LinkedIn persona rather than your Twitter persona. You know, everybody is marketing themselves. Everybody is representing their personal brand. And there's just a falseness to it. And I was in one such room and, you know, people are talking about various strategies for making a podcast successful. And the topic came up of a Canadian law, you know, a hate speech law. And one guy, a white guy, basically gave the standard social libertarian response of, you know, I don't want some government bureaucrat telling me what to say and what not to say. And I thought for a minute that he was going to get booted or that, you know, he was going to be shunned or something. And then other people started speaking up and saying basically the same thing, that they don't like, you know, this atmosphere of coercion, which has arisen around supposedly noble aims of, you know, racial justice, social equality. I say supposedly, I mean, those are noble aims. But they can be used to ill effect. They can be used to bully people. And they certainly have been. And then what I noticed was that some of the people who were speaking up and, you know, as soon as they heard somebody push back against that party line and not get, you know, dogpiled immediately, other people started to speak up. And some of the people speaking up were black. And suddenly the whole character of this room changed. It went from being this, you know, everybody's in the audio equivalent of their freshly pressed suit and tie, handing out business cards, you know, at some very respectable function, to all of that falls away and people are just suddenly sharing with one another and admitting that, you know, they're tired of the pretense. And they're tired of having to be careful and having to be afraid of saying something in politics, you know, something that can get you ostracized, socially, economically ostracized. And you might think that I would have been, you know, one of the leading voices in that room. I don't know that I actually spoke up on that topic at all. I think I was so stunned to hear all of these people who I would have expected, you know, to absolutely adhere to that social orthodoxy. As soon as they saw that there was an opening to push back against it, they did. But then I was down at Kevin's this past weekend, and we watched a segment of the Jimmy Dore show where he was watching and commenting on Jon Stewart of The Daily Show, previously of The Daily Show, going on Stephen Colbert's late night talk show program and doing a prepared comedic bit. You know, this wasn't off the cuff. This wasn't spontaneous. This was clearly something that, you know, Jon Stewart, a stand-up comedian, he had composed this bit and he was performing it in the context of this interview on Stephen Colbert's show.
And I honestly mean this. I think we owe a great debt of gratitude to science. Science has, in many ways, helped ease the suffering of this pandemic, which was more than likely caused by science. So, and that's kind of...
Hold on one second.
No. Listen.
What do you mean by that? Do you mean like there's a chance that this was created in a lab? There's an investigation.
A chance?
Well, there's evidence, I'd love to hear it.
There's
a
novel respiratory coronavirus overtaking Wuhan, China. What do? Oh, you know who we could ask? The Wuhan novel respiratory coronavirus lab. The disease is the same name as the lab. That's just a little too weird, don't you think? And then they ask those scientists, they're like, how did this... So wait a minute, you work at the Wuhan respiratory coronavirus lab. How did this happen? And they're like, a pangolin kissed a turtle. And you're like, no, if you look at the name, let me see your business card. Show me your business card. Oh, I work at the coronavirus lab in Wuhan. Oh, because there's a coronavirus loose in Wuhan. How did that happen? Maybe a bat flew into the cloaca of a turkey and then it sneezed into my chili and now we all have coronavirus. Like, come on.
Wait a second.
All right.
John.
Oh, my God. There's been an outbreak of chocolatey goodness near Hershey, Pennsylvania. What do you think happened? Like, oh, I don't know. Maybe a steam shovel mated with a cocoa bean. Or it's the chocolate factory. Maybe that's it.
That could be. That could be.
By the way, I gave them all tuberculosis.
That could very well be, and Anthony Fauci and Francis Collins at NIH have said, like, it should definitely be investigated.
Don't stop with the logic and people and things. The name of the disease.
Wait a second.
The building.
Wait a second. But it could be possible, you could be right, it could be possible that they have the lab in Wuhan to study the novel coronavirus diseases because in Wuhan, there are a lot of novel coronavirus diseases because of the bat population there.
I understand.
It's a local specialty,
and it's the only place to find bats. You won't find bats
anywhere else.
Austin, Texas has thousands of them that fly out of a cave every night. Every night at dusk. Is there a coronavirus, an Austin coronavirus? No, it doesn't seem to be an Austin coronavirus. The only coronavirus we have is in Wuhan.
Yes.
Where they have a lab called, what's the lab called again, Stephen?
The Wuhan Novel Coronavirus Lab.
I believe that's the case.
And now, how long have you worked for Senator Ron Johnson?
Let me tell you something about Ron Johnson. This is not a conspiracy. Here's the thing about science.
You could be right.
But this is the problem with science. Science is incredible. But they don't know when to stop. And nobody in the room with those cats ever goes, yeah, I don't know if we should do that. Like, they're... a few years back.
I agree with you. If science can do it, they will do it.
They will do it. They're like, oh, curiosity killed the cat. Oh, okay, well, let's kill 10,000 cats to find out why. And you're like, that's what science does. They push things. They do the thing like, okay, listen to this. So a few years back...
You know, we stopped filming a long time ago.
I understand that. Can I tell you something? This is what happens. I've been alone for so long. And when I realized that the laboratory was having the same name, first name and last name, of the evil that had been plaguing us, I thought to myself, that's up. Listen to what I'm saying.
John, I'll tell you what I'm suspicious of. I'll tell you what I'm suspicious of. I'm suspicious of the Daytona Beach Spring Break Herpes Lab. That might be where all the herpes comes from.
I've been to that lab.
Oh, I know. Oh, I know. We have to take a brief break, John.
What?
Yes. We'll be right back with more of wherever this edit happened. Stick around.
So that was not the entirety of John Stewart's appearance, but it was the meat of it. And the first time, you know, I saw this, I was seeing it in little segments because Jimmy Dore on his show was playing it and praising John Stewart and viciously criticizing Stephen Colbert. Here's a taste of the context in which I first heard about John Stewart in his, you know, Wuhan lab rant or bit.
Which was more than likely caused by science.
Now, Stephen Colbert, I don't know if you can see the look on his face, but he's saying, am I allowed to laugh at this? Is this okay, or will this get me in trouble? Which is the last thing a comedian should be thinking. But it's the first thing he's thinking, because he's an establishment tool now, 100%. 100%. So he doesn't, his audience laughed at Jon Stewart. He didn't. He's worried. That's what that look on his face says. A comedian's joking around about an open investigation. This might get me in hot water. The whole audience is applauding and going crazy, and Stephen Colbert is trying to kneecap Jon Stewart's comedic bit. He's trying to kneecap his comedian. He's trying to cut the legs out from underneath what Jon Stewart is saying. Why? Because Stephen Colbert is a huge fucking pussy. He's a corporate mouthpiece now. He's an establishment puking, pablum spewing insult to his former self and an insult to comedy. That's what Stephen Colbert has become. And he's revealing it right now when a real comedian who, guess which one of these comedians isn't taking a corporate paycheck right now? Guess which one?
All right, so Jimmy Dore went on in that vein for quite some time, just, you know, dragging Stephen Colbert through the mud, castigating him, insulting him. And I agree that the Stephen Colbert, who is a late night talk show host today, seems like a pale imitation, or you could even say a sorry excuse for the Stephen Colbert of, you know, the Colbert Report, or the Stephen Colbert who, you know, was the entertainment at that press correspondence dinner where, you know, he was pretending to be a hardcore right-wing, you know, Republican social commentator, but in fact was using that persona to skewer George W. Bush and the Bush administration. You know, doing that in a room where nobody's laughing because everybody's just astonished that he's made it to this event. But, you know, he's presenting comedy, and this is the hardest of hard rooms, you know? Like, maybe some of the journalists in the room think that what he's saying is funny, but they don't dare laugh. And the people who invited him there, because they didn't realize that he was pretending to be a right-wing commentator, you know, in the style of Bill O'Reilly, but was really doing, you know, a sort of leftist parody of that form, they're just staring daggers at the guy, and yet he goes for it. I don't remember what year that was, but that would have been, I think, you know, it was during the Bush administration, so in the aughts. That guy had enormous cojones. That guy had, you know, that guy was courageous. The Stephen Colbert of today, with his late night talk show, you know, with the big band, it's the David, I was going to say David Letterman, really, it's the Johnny Carson formula. Band, celebrity guests, occasional comedian, and it's just vapid. And Stephen Colbert is a mouthpiece for, you know, the party line. Just the neoliberal DNC party line. And I don't care really about anything that he's doing these days. But in this particular instance, I think Jimmy Dore is wrong. Watching from the very beginning, that whole segment with Jon Stewart on Stephen Colbert's late night talk show, whatever it's called, I think Stephen Colbert was in on it. I think he was playing at objecting to Jon's his bit, you know, his routine. And I think he was deliberately making ridiculous arguments that the Wuhan laboratory, you know, the coronavirus laboratory in Wuhan is situated there because there's so much coronavirus in that area. I don't think he believes that. And I don't think he even intended anybody to take that seriously. I think he was deliberately offering that up as a ridiculous argument to tee up Jon Stewart. And, you know, the show is pre-recorded. It didn't go out live. You know, when Stephen Colbert says, you know, we stopped filming minutes ago. And later he says, we'll come back and follow up on, you know, wherever that was edited. He's in on the joke. So I think Jimmy Dore was basically missing a whole layer of nuance in terms of that appearance. But what's interesting about it is I went on Twitter afterwards just to see what people were saying. And like Dan Rather has this stuffy, offended tweet about, you know, Jon Stewart being dangerous for not respecting science or whatever. Like Dan Rather didn't even get the layer. There were layers of nuance that Jimmy Dore did get that Dan Rather just nothing. No comprehension. But then other people were saying, look, Jon Stewart, he has a lot of goodwill built up over many years of doing what he does on the left. If Jon Stewart can come out onto this mainstream, what is it, CBS late night talk show and deliver this presentation, again, it's not live. These late night shows are pre-recorded. So if Jon Stewart had done something that the powers that be disagreed with, you know, if the CBS executives really didn't like this rant, they wouldn't air it. It wasn't live. So the fact that it did get aired in its entirety with Stephen Colbert's lame attempts to hold up the standard narrative, I'm pretty sure Stephen Colbert was in on it. And so the opinion that I was picking up on from Twitter was people saying, yeah, this is the establishment correcting itself. This is the establishment abandoning this previous position, this position that said you absolutely may not even speculate about the Wuhan coronavirus having come from the Wuhan coronavirus lab. You can't even say that. You can't suggest it. You can't ask the question. If you do, it's because you're a racist. You're an anti-Chinese racist. And if you mention even the mere possibility that the Wuhan coronavirus lab had anything to do with the Wuhan coronavirus, that means that you hate Asian people and you want them to be assaulted. And I found people on Twitter saying exactly that. You know, they're still with that old line. But I think this is, or at least I'm not saying this is what's happening. I'm not saying this is the case, but the suggestion that the powers that be are using Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert to retract or to ease up on this really ridiculous narrative that they had laid down with such authority and such vengeance, you know, for people who would violate it. I think that narrative has passed its usefulness. So Michael Tracy, kind of an alt journalist, he tweeted, you know, a link to this clip. And then his tweet was, Stephen Colbert was hilariously uncomfortable that one of his heroes, Jon Stewart, came on his first show back in studio to essentially endorse the lab leak theory. 6 months ago, he'd have to condemn Stewart as a right-wing xenophobic conspiracy theorist. And then somebody else, this is a person I don't know, but he's responding to Michael Tracy, this Cabot Rafter writes, looks like Stewart is back in his role as semi-official policy mouthpiece. His job is to soften the cynical responses like he did with ACA passage while Dad is away on his big business trip. My guess, we're a few days away from the leak being the consensus conclusion. Now, there's a lot of people who are very attached to this, you know, this notion that you're not allowed to say that the Wuhan coronavirus might have come from the Wuhan coronavirus lab. And they're not going to give it up in a few days, particularly because, you know, it's an excuse to call people racist. And it's so deliciously intoxicating to call somebody a racist. So, you know, people are not going to give it up that easily. So I think the idea that, you know, a few days from now, Jon Stewart's, you know, the lab leak hypothesis will be the mainstream consensus. I don't think that's possible. I think we need more than a few days to turn that ship. Somebody else posted, now we need to get John to talk about ivermectin. Now, toward the end there, Stephen Colbert asked, so how long have you worked for Senator Ron Johnson? Senator Ron Johnson tweeted about this. He writes, John, at John Stewart, at Stephen at home, enjoyed your late night Wuhan virus discussion. Since I was mentioned, let me share this email I got from a constituent. Open minds can save lives. Constituent writes, good morning. I'm writing today to thank you for your leadership in Wisconsin as it relates to COVID and alternative treatments. My wife and I watched Dr. Pierre Corey testify before the Senate Committee on Ivermectin, December 8th, 2020. And we were utterly dumbfounded that this treatment was not readily available as treatment and prevention to the general public. Little did we know how valuable this hearing would be for us. In late May, my wife succumbed to the COVID virus. Her case was quite severe. She will report that she has never experienced the severity of headaches and body aches in her lifetime, as well as severe nausea and high temperatures. We pursued help through one medical establishment via urgent care. She was tested for COVID, confirmed positive, told to hydrate, provided an anti-nausea prescription, and told to take Tylenol. Over the days, her symptoms worsened and her temperature increased to 102.7. We thought it best to go to a local emergency room, different medical provider than the above urgent care. Her experience was abominable. After explaining her pain and symptoms, she was provided a narcotic for pain and a sleeping pill prescription. She was then told to tell friends and family to get vaccinated based on her severe case and sent home. As the days progressed, she grew so weak that she was not able to walk without assistance. She is a healthy, physically active woman who exercises every day and eats very healthy on a regular basis. As her symptoms worsened, I remembered the hearing you hosted with Dr. Corey. Through your leadership on this issue, I was finally able to connect with a Green Bay doctor that provided my wife real treatment, ivermectin and other support prescriptions. Within an hour of taking ivermectin, her headaches were gone. As an average citizen, it is very troubling to me to know that this information is being suppressed. I am grateful for your leadership on this challenging topic. I can safely say it has impacted our life in a very real way. Thank you. The letter is, you know, the senator did not identify the writer of that letter. So take that for what you will. But the ivermectin connection is interesting. Rodrigo Duterte, the president of the Philippines, had a I wouldn't say a press conference. He addressed the nation, basically. He's wearing a mask, and he told people who were hesitant about getting vaccinated, get vaccinated or I'm throwing you in jail. And then he said, and jail cells are filthy. The police are really lazy about cleaning them. They smell bad. They're really miserable places. You don't want to be there. And then at the end of this presentation, Rodrigo Duterte, president of the Philippines, said, and if we arrest you, we're going to inject you with ivermectin, which was developed for pigs. Okay. Anyway. A lot of people very mad at Jon Stewart over the weekend for daring to suggest the lab leak hypothesis might be correct, you know, in this comedic way. I mean, I was just laughing the whole time watching this. Not because, you know, I'm saying, oh, yes, tell the truth, Jon Stewart. Like, no, he's a funny guy. He's a very accomplished comedian. And, you know, regardless of your feelings about the whole Wuhan lab leak. That was funny. Some funny stuff. And one viewpoint that I'm seeing a lot here on Twitter, which I haven't mentioned yet. This one is a good example. The Spectator World, blue checkmarked, writes, "We all know that Jon Stewart would never have dared voice the Wuhan lab leak theory, which he now regards as so blindingly obvious, on television last year. That would have actually taken courage." So, not soon enough, Jon Stewart. Now, this is weird. Rolling Stone posted a link to the segment. The text of their tweet is, "Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart discussed the COVID-19 Wuhan lab theory on The Late Show." This thing's got 61 likes, 14 retweets, but only 6 comments, and it's from Rolling Stone. And the comments are vacuous. Weird. All right, well now, let's move on to the final piece that I want to talk about. There are people who insist that the vaccine is deadly and that within 2 years' time, almost everybody who's been vaccinated will be dead. The only people left will be those who are mistrustful of government and science and refused to get the vaccination. Now, I know a lot of people who have not been vaccinated and will not be vaccinated, and, you know, fine. And you know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'll be dead in 6 months or 2 years, you know, whatever. But if I were the evil overlords and I were concocting my plan to reduce the population and I wanted to remain in power, I would arrange my scheme so that the people who refused to get vaccinated, you know, the cantankerous people, the ornery ones, the ones that are hard to control, who resent your efforts at control, I'd scheme it so that those were the ones who died. And that the obedient ones, the, you know, the docile, overly socialized city humans were the ones that I kept around to, you know, keep paying the taxes and worshiping me. But apparently it's a TikTok genre of, you know, people who just articulating their belief that they're walking around in a world full of soon to be dead people, you know, which on a long enough timeline, we all are. On a long enough timeline, survival rates for everybody drop to zero, as Tyler Durden said. But these folks think it's 6 months to 2 years and everybody who's been vaccinated will either be dead or they will be sterile. So the demographic collapse, the actual demographic collapse of so-called, you know, advanced nations, where birth rates have dropped below replacement rates, that will be nothing compared to, you know, this fantasy scenario, wherein most everybody's dead and most everybody else who survived is infertile. And so that's it for humanity, except for the brave malcontents who don't like to be told what to do. They're the only ones who will survive, and they will be the mothers and fathers of the new humanity. What an interesting world to live in. You know, for a time, when I was drinking the peak oil Kool-Aid, I would move through the world, and I would see businesses, organizations, social activities, which to me seemed absolutely doomed and pointless, and I knew that they would soon all be washed away. They would just collapse with all of the rest of the industrial infrastructure that is the basis of our industrial society, that it would all fall apart within a couple of years, and that we would all be doing something radically different, those of us who survived. Wasn't always a great feeling. You know, I describe it like I was one of the elect, and I had no reason to believe that I would do all that well in the transition. So, on that topic of doom. You know, the audience for this podcast is pretty small, but it's a really interesting audience with a lot of connections to unlikely places, unlikely social strata, people who are placed in organizations which are just surprising. You wouldn't expect from such a small sampling of the population. And I'm sure I'm pretty sure that somebody listening to me speak these words, somebody who pays for this podcast, either believes that people like me who got the vaccine will soon be dead, or you closely associate, possibly are related to, possibly are married to, somebody who believes that. And you know, I freely admit, it might be true. But I find it very difficult to take the idea seriously. And that just may be a, you know, crucial vulnerability on my part, that I can't look at the truth and see it for what it is. But to me, it has the hallmarks of a transformational fantasy. You know, transformational fantasy is you just don't have the patience for, say, building a political movement. You want your guy, your heroic transformational figure who's going to come in and change everything, like Donald Trump was to the Trump folk. And I'll fully admit, what Andrew Yang was to the Yang Gang when he was running for president, you know, he was talking about a change that was so radical that none of the other candidates, except maybe Marianne Williamson, could possibly even entertain it at the time. Within a few months, you know, the government was sending checks out to people. But at the time, it was completely transformational. And I made some videos where I was saying, I really like Andrew Yang. I like his message. I like what he's talking about. Not a huge fan of UBI necessarily, but I like his vision, you know, and I like his style. And I don't think he's going to be elected president in 2020, but I think this is a really good introduction. You know, this is a good way to get him into the public eye. And, you know, there'll be another election in a few years. And, you know, he's got some time to start building a career. This is a guy who's really going to be with us for a long time. He's going to do some good. And I got angry, angry pushback from the Yang Gang, certain corners of the Yang Gang, I should say, you know, accusing me of not really supporting him, of being a crypto Bernie bro, you know, of really saying nice things about Andrew Yang as a pretense for really cutting him down and denying the possibility. And I had so many people write to me and tell me, not so many, enough that I saw a pattern. People would write to me and say, there isn't time. If it's not now, if he doesn't win this election, it's all over. And it's not all over. Time just keeps going on, and the processes of civilization just keep turning over. They just, you know, they keep going around the track. And they're going to keep doing it, even after you and I have left the scene. And there is time for Andrew Yang to build a career. He's running for mayor of New York City. The election is today. By the time you hear these words, he will either have won or lost. But a transformational ideology, a transformational fantasy, is one that says, I just don't have the patience or the willingness to contemplate a slow, iterative progression to something different and better. I need everything to change overnight, right now. That's the vision of the singularitarians, although the singularitarians tend to be pretty happy with the way things are right now, and they think things are only going to get better. So they're still caught up in a transformational fantasy, but it's not one that is necessarily based on, you know, absolutely not being able to stand the current system anymore. But, you know, the Marxist Revolution, I mean, that's the pinnacle. That is, everything must change right now, and the way we're going to do it is all the people with the correct vision are going to get guns, and they're going to kill all the people who want anything other than what we want. We are going to seize power through violence and implement, at gunpoint, universal love. Transformational ideology. Transformations do happen. You know, that giant meteor, when it hit the Earth, everything changed. Everything changed that day. A huge coronal mass ejection that just wipes out the electric grid and all electronics on half the planet. that would be a transformational moment. And those CMEs and supervolcanic eruptions and big rocks falling on the Earth from space, those absolutely positively will happen repeatedly in the future. But the time spans, you know, the time between those events happening, thousands of years, tens of thousands of years, hundreds, millions of years, in terms of the flow of our politics and our civilization, don't be waiting on that. You know, my whole life, from the time I was old enough to understand what infectious disease is and what plagues and pandemics are, I was hearing people predicting that there would be a global pandemic that would destroy civilization. Well, we just had a global pandemic. The virus didn't have a very high lethality rate, but as a society, we really fumbled. And we're continuing to fumble it. We're doing it wrong. We are messing up. And yet, civilization has not collapsed. I know, it's going to. It's in the process. I mean, I know this is just a bummer of a message. Things are going to continue pretty much as they are, but getting slowly suckier for people for whom things are already sucky. And people who are doing well materially are going to be freaked out because there's so many miserable, angry people around them. Like there is now. Only slightly worse. And so here's the message that the Marxists really hate. Or, you know, any woke lefty really hates. Because it's the bootstrap message. You're not going to change the big picture. The big picture will change over time, incrementally, iteratively, but not in some sweeping transformation, and certainly not a sweeping transformation that answers to all of your fondest desires. What you do have control over, or some control over, is your attitude, your actions, your outlook, your approach, your life strategy. Basically, you get to work on yourself. That's the place where you have high leverage. Transforming society, you have no leverage. Okay. I actually still have 1,000 words to write today. So I'm going to stop speaking into this microphone, edit this stuff, put it up online, and then get to writing. So some of what I write you'll hear on these podcasts, but most of it just goes up on the Patreon page. Sometimes I put it behind a paywall, sometimes not. I'm pretty capricious about that. But even if you are subscribed through crealm.com and not through Patreon, if you want access, if you go to my Patreon page and you see that there's a post that's blurred out, you can't see it because you're not subscribed through Patreon, let me know. I will send you the text. All right, that is all for this episode. Thank you for subscribing, for listening, for caring. So, after everything I've just said, if it sounded like criticism of you, and just something, some niggling little voice in the back of your head that says, yeah, this is criticism of me, well, go easy on yourself. We're all learning. And as far as I know, as far as I remember, I haven't lived before, never been in this exact situation before. We learn as we go. And we'll talk to you again soon. Stay well.